This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, April 24th, 2012.
Okay. I call this meeting to order at 4:35. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from April 10th. Are there any changes to the minutes? Evan?
I have some changes in there. I don't know how granular you want it. There were a couple of names that were spelled wrong. Nelson Ross, so I'm sure he would appreciate the irony or whatever, is fairly consistently called Nelson Rath.
Again?
R-A-T-H. It's right at the very top, but it's wrong for the rest of the document.
Where's the string then?
On page 3, it's the JCC, her last name is Pippelman, H-I-P-P-E-L-M-A-N, H-E-T-T. Should I keep talking? Somebody writing down? Wonderful. So it's the third paragraph under D, the Resolution 7, where it says Rath, which is Ross. In that next paragraph, Matthew Campbell's amendment was that there was an amendment to the third amendment, so the additional resolve clause about education. His concern, what he wanted was that there would be language requiring the UA to bring this issue up again next year. So I after it says M. Campbell suggested, what I wrote was that the language include a requirement that the UA return to this issue in the future. This is the fourth paragraph under D, which is the section on Resolution 7.
Okay.
So about halfway down, M. Campbell suggested that the language include a requirement that the UA return to this issue in the future. I've got this all in track changes, so I can just sort of say it out. And if anybody objects to my version of the facts, then say something. But if not, I can just email it later. E. Cortens agreed with his suggestion, but said that even with the language, it wouldn't guarantee the UA would return to the issue. So on and so forth. My other thought in this section and the next section is that we talk about these amendments, but it doesn't actually say anywhere in the agenda or the minutes what the amendments were. So there's all this talk about this amendment was offered, this amendment was offered to the amendment, but it doesn't say what any of that was. I mean, maybe that's a big request, but you know, I would suggest that at the very least, somebody doesn't want to sit and go through the audio and add in all the amendments to the amendments. So at the very least, we have in the minutes the final text of the amendment, either as adopted or as rejected. Okay.
Yeah.
Likewise for the second section, under external amendment, Bowman, third paragraph, clarified that Kevin Claremont was talking about protection against self-incrimination. E. Cortens felt that while the OCR letter implied the existence of a hearing, it didn't explicitly require it. K. Claremont clarified it all had to bow to due process. I didn't understand that sentence. Continuing on, E. Cortens thought that some of what was underlying this discussion was the implication that there would be many false reports. He clarified that the data suggests these are very rare and that policy 6.4 provided clear sanctions against falsely reported cases. The only other thing I had was a minor fact. Anyway, that if nobody disagrees with my version of what I said. Okay.
Were there any other changes?
I'll just send them as
I had two, Madam Chair. First on page 1,
mm-hmm.
paragraph 5, or V, alpha, 5 alpha new business. Third line, last few words say tech candidate nominee. You see him? I would strike the words tech candidate and just leave it as he informed the UA Andrew Watts has been chosen as the nominee. on page 3, second paragraph, which begins, J. Blair asked. The end of the third line says, J. Blair asked what the role of the dean is. There needs to be a period after the word is. And then the other thing I noticed is the abstentions were not listed in the minutes. I don't know whether that's now minute standard. Do we need to go back and put in the abstentions?
I actually can. The GPSA has probably been infecting people's minutes with this. What Robert's rule says is that it's not proper to call for the abstentions or record the abstentions unless you need to make sure that they're recorded so that you show a quorum was present. Because all of these votes, there were enough people voting that they show the quorum is present, the abstentions don't matter. The reasoning for this is it doesn't matter in the eyes of Robert's rules why you didn't vote. You could have been in Indonesia, you could have been out of the room in the bathroom, you could have been sitting in the room and choosing not to vote. It doesn't matter. What matters is whether you voted yes or you voted no.
Well, that makes it easy. I won't worry about the abstentions then. Page 5.
We're duly infected.
Two sentences above adjourns. It says, J. Blair called the question, period. He motion passed 12-0. Should be the motion.
I also, on that same sentence, I clarified that it was called the question on Resolution 7, since there was a separate one a couple lines earlier where it was talking about the amendment.
That's everything from there. And whoever did the minutes, thank you, because these were tough. I mean, it sounds like there are a lot of questions, but these were very, very tough.
Okay, any other changes to the minutes? Is there a motion to pass the minutes? Evan, second. Ramsey, all those in favor? All those opposed? Motion passes 10-0. Okay. Next item on the agenda is updates from the committee, so the Campus Infrastructure Committee.
Joe Lowy is going to be coming in later this meeting to talk about the proposed parking plan changes, and so we'll talk to hear from him later. We also, I guess we have a meeting coming up on Monday, so interesting.
Okay, Campus Welfare Committee.
So what we did in this meeting is that we talked about the two proposed resolutions, one concerning course evaluations and the second one concerning diversity. In terms of course evaluations, we talked about it, and there's some things that we wanted to clarify before we proposed it.
Okay.
Number one, with the engineering course evaluations, how did they, go about talking to the faculty and the staff, not faculty and staff, but faculty, in terms of making them more lean and more open to having the, and then also was ensuring, seeing what programs they use and finding a way to integrate that or use that same software. In terms of the diversity resolution, we tweaked it up a bit. They were largely supportive. They just said, make it shorter, fit it into one page. We haven't received the feedback from Diversity and Inclusion Department yet, so that's something that we included into it. We agreed to include it once we got those things. But David, go ahead.
What was the they in this? You said they want
The committee members.
The committee members.
Okay. We can talk about that more whenever it comes up under new business.
Yep. I just wanted to ask if you could explain what the course evaluation resolution is about.
So the course evaluation...
That's actually under new business if you want to talk about it then, or you can talk about it.
We can talk about it.
Oh, okay. At the end, right.
Yes.
But we're not doing a resolution today, right?
No.
And then last but not least, we spent some time discussing how we can make the committee better in the future, room for improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they brought up was they brought the idea of assigning each person a role, so ensuring communication across the different assemblies. Because in the beginning, one of the issues was finding something that was engaging or something that was disrupting our our constituents. And then the second thing was many people were not aware, or at least initially, of the function of the University Assembly, and they said, you know, ensuring or better defining the role of the UA would help them. And am I missing anything else, or is that for the most part what we talked about? Okay. That was about it. So.
Okay. And the CJC?
I don't see Phil here, so I'll give a quick update. You'll see later in today's meeting there's Resolution 7 to amend the Campus Code of Conduct. Kathy Zoner will be here in 20-ish minutes to help present that resolution to the members, followed by Resolution 11 to changes to the Campus Code. One of the sponsors, Peter, is here, but Mary Beth Grant should also be here in about 30 minutes to help us walk through those things. The one piece of important unresolved at the moment CJC business is the University Hearing and Review Board. We have done about 30 interviews. There were 13 more to do this week, some of which may have already happened. But I think by the end of this week we should be through all the interviews. And then the CJC will put forward a slate of candidates for the University Hearing and Review Board for UA approval. This being our last business meeting, depending on how that comes forward and what happens at our next meeting, which is supposed to be purely social and changeover, we can either choose to vote on the list then, or we can leave it to the UA exec for the summer and then vote on it the first meeting next term. That is what happened this year. So it's not a crisis for us, whatever the outcome. The process is moving forward. They couldn't be ready for it today. And that's it.
Okay. And then moving on to new business, item A is Resolution 9. If Ramsey, you want to present Resolution 9?
So Resolution 9 hasn't changed for the most part between the version that was sent out and the most recent version approved. That would accommodate both the needs of the committee as well as Division of HR Workforce Service and Inclusion. Put simply, I aggregated the whereas clauses compared to the last draft that you've seen. So I've merged them together to take up less space. And instead of the office, it's been changed to the DIWD, and that stands for Department of Inclusion and Workforce Diversity. Other than that, no other changes have been made. The essence of the resolution is the same.
So what drove the resolution, Ramsey, and why do you want us to pass a resolution on this?
The reason why I want to pass this resolution is because they're the ones who we largely worked with throughout this year, between receiving updates from them, between them presenting the issues that they're encountering, the initiatives that they're pursuing, and in a way, between... the feedback that we gave them, between the suggestions that we gave them, they used those, they thanked us, and they actually progressed with it. And me personally, working with them, between the bias response since last year, I've continued that commitment this year as well. Between creating the app, the bias response app, as well as starting to integrate a diversity page. Because some colleges don't even have a diversity page. So between ensuring that across the different colleges, I feel that that's something to recognize. And more importantly, also the colleague network groups. So I feel like they're engaging the constituencies on different levels. And throughout the year, they've always been open to us in terms of saying, hey, this is how you can help. Hey, this is, I feel like they've been proactive, and if anything, I appreciate that. And, I don't know. That's what I want to highlight.
And I assume that's the sentiment of the Campus Welfare Committee writ large?
Yes.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Yeah.
Yeah, just for background, I went over why it came up, actually, and now you explain how your interaction. Is it that they did more, or that they did it better? But why aren't we seeing this for every committee that we interact with?
that we're not seeing positive results for every committee?
Well, no, no. Why single out this one unit for praise? Is it because they're better, actually?
No, I never said that they were better than any other committee.
Well, then maybe we should... Yeah, I'm just wondering. You did single them out.
They're the ones that we've worked largely with throughout this year. So...
In other words, why should we send President Scorton or Mary Opperman, somebody like that? The UA wants to thank...
I think that the key figure is the second dissolve clause, right? Strives to ensure adequate resources are allocated to the office to allow them to carry out and expand these programs. So your resolution is saying that you believe the work they do is valuable and should continue to be, in a time of tight budget, continue to be supported?
Yes. That, like, I stress diversity a lot. I've seen bias on campus, and I feel like this is an important issue to ensure, and I feel it's really important to ensure resources are allocated for that. Yes.
That's not the resolution, though.
No.
I mean, the resolution is praise, that's all. The
resolution is praise, and then making sure you have enough resources for it.
And that's really the rationale for the resolution, as he would describe. So I'm just a little uneasy about picking out one group to praise. And in particular, you could ask what other things money might be spent on in kind of competition with this, if you haven't said something. And this is picking them out as being especially worthy or having done especially large numbers of things, or and I'm hearing both, kind of. And I guess I don't actually see that the comparison, I think it's a comparison, and I don't see a comparison.
You know, you may be right, but this is something that came from the Campus Welfare Committee to praise the people that had come in to spend a fair amount of time over the year, and it may be a good thing for the other committees to do similarly, if they have such a good experience.
To encourage.
But what's that?
To encourage other committees to do so.
Yeah. And but Ramsey thought of this, and I think that maybe it's a good thought for the other committees to do then in the future, well, for the next meeting.
Yeah, this isn't actually a committee. I mean, this is the division of the university.
No, but the Campus Welfare Committee.
That's the committee. But
yeah.
I guess I don't buy it, actually.
This is up for the UA to decide whether we want to pass a resolution on praise, but we need to base that decision on knowing that the Campus Welfare Committee saw it as important. So that's just for information.
Yep, that's what it says. And I'm saying there are other things that are important too, and there are other things that require funds. And this is picking them out for either being better in kind than everyone else or doing more. And maybe you're saying it's false.
Where does the resolution say that they're better?
I'm just saying...
I understand what he's saying. It's an intellectual issue.
Yeah,
there are many people doing great things on the campus. Ramsey is and the CWC have put forward the resolution that it's nice. What's the net effect of it? And have we thought about it in the context of what about CIT? What about other groups, the people that have supported the parking and other things? You know, it's a value judgment, but have they been so extraordinary or gone so out of their way to help the CWC do their work that they should be singled out by the UA, I think is the point of his question or his concern.
Well,
not that he objects with anything written. The question is, we don't have one for other groups.
Have other groups worked closely with the CWC this semester, like CIT?
No.
No, we're only transportation working with the infrastructure committee. So we thank you all.
Yeah, Evan?
I have a small amendment to what is line 13 on my document. I think it's line 12 on that document. To transpose the S and the apostrophe. Bright Horizons apostrophe rather than Bright Horizon apostrophe S. I don't imagine there's going to be any objection to that amendment. That's the name of the company.
No objection.
But I did have a question as well. I followed all of the stuff about the Office of Workforce Diversity and Inclusion, but I didn't quite follow how the discussion of Bright Horizons and the Child Care Center and field trips and satisfaction survey was
associated
fit into that.
So Linda, who's part of the division, worked closely with them, and I think you remember her from
Nicole Howard
from last year, and she's been deeply involved with those kinds of initiatives, and she actually gave us updates on that, and we gave her room for improvement in terms of, you know, what we can do to better resolve that. Earlier in the year, she mentioned of how, you know, field trips was something that was not included on it, but with our next by talking with her later in the year, she said they started incorporating that, and that satisfaction rates are actually even higher. So it's between recognizing us, coming to us, you know, with these issues, and then actually yielding results from the suggestions that we give, that I appreciate, you know, number one, it gives legitimacy to the campus welfare. And for that part of it, I wanted to highlight that change.
Gotcha. I have one other small thing, speaking of small amendments. I don't know what the language currently is in the document. The one that I have, it says, has been taking advantage of Cornell's unique resources. You still say that? It does still say that. I think that could possibly have a negative connotation. I would suggest language like has been making use of Cornell's unique resources.
You're making good use.
Making good use.
Well, that's, you know.
As good as use as everybody else. Yes.
Howie?
Yeah, no, I talked to a couple faculty members in our department who are using Bright Horizons, actually. And they weren't aware of anything having to do with the division in any of their work. So it's pretty separated from the actual users community. That's just a one. And so I would say it's not really that visible. Maybe it's all happening in the background, but they're not aware of it. And before, I could say a couple of years ago, there was considerable censor, really, of the workforce diversity department, we'll call it, because of Bright Horizons and what was happening. And if you recall, in the Senate, there was a lot of it was a white paper, and basically there wasn't a censor by us at that time, right?
Actually, there was a censor. There were a bunch of resolutions calling for severing the relationship with Bright Horizons, and
but that where they weren't voted. Yes,
they were voted upon. They were.
Yeah,
I believe they were not adopted.
And Charlie Wolf, I personally led a big session, and HR took on, you know, the surveys and stuff, and we saw at least statistically improvement, and we got reports from user parents that things had greatly improved.
Yes, that is clear, and also in the Senate that was gone over not as often, but a lot. And so I think it's somewhat ironic to give them praise in the third year while we were kind of not giving them praise in the first year.
It's not ironic. It's showing that they've improved.
But they were so bad.
And now they're better.
I didn't want to put it that way. But
the UA voted not.
It is actually correct. Actually.
Yeah.
That was
they were so bad, it was the Family Services Subcommittee and the Faculty Senate, Child Care Subcommittee and the Faculty Senate,
in the White House,
that provided enough friction for HR to stop pretending everything's okay.
Yep.
And do their job. Mm-hmm. But saying that, and I hope it gets in the minutes, that they really have done their job since then.
Yeah, but they're just doing their job.
Okay, yeah, Howie.
I just have a couple of comments. And my point of order was people should be recognized. The comment I want to make is on line 48, very minor one. the job of the office continues to plan in advance these important initiates for the initiatives.
It's line 35.
The air is still there. Line 35 is copied.
Yeah.
Okay.
Important initiatives.
And I can see line 41, there's a space after the resolve before the comma.
I fixed that in my correction.
So much for mine. Anyway, the other point I want to make is that this resolve that the President's office strives to ensure adequate resources are allocated to the office to allow them to carry out and expand these programs. That's a little harsh, is it not? I mean, has the President not been ensuring adequate resources? Do we know that they haven't been? I mean,
have there been sentiments that they haven't been given adequate resources?
No, I'm not. Question. In terms of whether they have adequate resources or not currently, that's something that did not bring up personally. But what I want to make sure is that they have enough resources to continue to do what they want, like to continue to pursue those endeavors, especially with the sandwich generation and the bias response.
So would there be an amendment to that resolve clause to say something along the lines to continue to ensure adequate resources if there haven't been someone against it?
I think I'm with my colleague here that you know, I want the library to have adequate resources. I want all kinds of things to have adequate resources. I think that's a strong point that praising one without having some. I mean, if you want to have a motion for every ready portion of a university so that they don't just get their feelings hurt, I mean, this is the road to go down. I don't think it's a good idea.
One thought I had is that you're not necessarily picking them out for being better or something else. You might be pointing out someone you think their work is important and might be overlooked. The library is a very visible resource on campus. You're not going to be as likely to forget it as something that I personally, you know, didn't know much about until I came across it through the city. You know what I'm saying?
I think also by that argument, any time a resolution was proposed singling out any part of the institution, sorry.
No, I was out of order.
Okay.
Go ahead.
By that line of reasoning, it seems like any time you have a resolution that is singling out any institution, any part of the institution for any positive or negative feedback, it's not acceptable unless every other unit is also addressed in exactly the same way. That doesn't seem like is the issue here that it's positive feedback and it's not fair to give positive feedback to one unit without giving positive feedback to others?
That's a complete misrepresentation of what I'm saying. Because if everybody else is doing a great job, then what you said is true. But if you really think that if everyone's equal, then you have to give to everyone. But this is pointing out one that's sticking up in a positive direction, it seems to me. And that's a slippery road, or a slippery slope, actually.
Because we might start to have to praise others.
No. I don't think we should be praising everybody to the sky necessarily, unless we can really find a substantive reason that compared to everybody else, they really have risen to that position. And I don't see that.
Evan?
Seeing that we're now about 10 minutes over on this item on the agenda, I'd like to call a question.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor, calling question. Motion passes 12-0.
That's the call. To call the question?
Oh, to call the question, yeah. All those in favor of the resolution? All opposed?
Motion passes 9-3. Okay, next item on the agenda is Resolution 10, and we're going to have Kathy Zoner present this resolution.
Kathy Zoner. Hi, everybody. I just ran in here. So this might look familiar to members of the Assembly. In 2009, we presented almost the exact same resolution, certainly the wording that we're proposing to use is the same SEVA and slash org that has been modified. The resolution we brought forward because of continuing dangers in the Fall Creek Gorge area of existing legislation in the Ithaca city ordinance that Cornell Police cannot enforce absent this resolution. We want to make sure that we're doing the best we can to use education and enforcement as part of how we keep people out of the Fall Creek areas for swimming. Since the time that we brought it forward, they have had two drowning-related deaths in Mr. Castro and Mr. Rand. We've had a couple different rescues by the city police. And there are a number of dangers that continue on, no matter what we do around that area, whether the trails are improved and sodding and fencing is improved, it's still, we need to break the habit, as it were. The fact of the matter is, if the city police can't handle it on their own, certainly they have their own endangered areas that they have to maintain that are outside Cornell's property, and this is a way that we can provide assistance. So we're proposing that we add to Title 3, Article 2, Section 8.3, amending paragraph L, I believe it is, and the L would read, to enter any waters, it would be a violation of the code, to enter any waters of Fall Creek, Cascula Creek, or Beauty Lake that are on or traverse the campus within the city of Ithaca for the purpose of swimming or bathing, except in those waters officially designated as swimming or bathing waters. And this almost directly mimics the municipal ordinance.
Okay. Evan, do you have a question?
So I am on the Codes and Judicial Committee. I voted in favor of this resolution, as did every other member present. I'm very much in favor of it. This is behavior that, as Chief Zoner pointed out, is already illegal. It's a violation of the City of Ithaca Municipal Code. It's dangerous. It's not representative of the kind of conduct that we condone on this campus, and I encourage the members of the University Assembly to vote for Resolution 10.
Peter, do you have a comment as well?
I'm here representing the City Assembly, and just wanted to put my full support behind this. Some people were concerned about this article, but I'm assuming somebody feels as though that this is necessary. It is an educational program, and we need enforcement to further that education, that the gorges are dangerous.
So,
just obviously representing, my constituency of students, when you're a freshman here or a sophomore, it's very common to go on a social media site like Facebook or Twitter and see pictures of your friends and colleagues in bathing suits down by the gorges. It's almost like a rite of passage, so to speak. It's also very common and almost like a rite of passage to hear stories of how people almost got seriously hurt down there, or how they did something that, and how they're laughing about it, how they didn't really hurt themselves. And then you hear stories about Mr. Lowe 3 years ago and how it ended up in a different way. And it's remarkable how 200 plus years into this university's history, how our campus code is still out of touch with stuff like that. So I think this would be a great step in the right direction to really try to curb that change and make this a safer campus.
Yes, I'm a bit concerned about this resolution. I guess I don't understand if it's already against the municipal code. I don't understand what we will gain by having the code of conduct overlap with the municipal code. I don't see this being, your response, but my initial reaction is I don't understand why this is the sort of thing that for which we would want to have double punishment, or why we would want, how the code and our local law seem duplicative would be helpful.
Kathy, do you have a...
Sure. But as you take a look at the code, the majority of the code is duplicative, whether it be a state criminal law or a municipal code or any one of any number of other different violations of federal law, federal local law. In this particular case, there is the waters of Fall Creek belong to the state, and they don't belong to Cornell University. Our powers are limited within our powers of enforcing the law, so hence the municipal code, are limited to those properties that are owned and controlled, supervised, and maintained by Cornell University by education law. When we enter it into the code, we actually, we're not in a position to do double jeopardy. We're in a position to do single jeopardy. We can get you into the JA system. We can get someone who is violating this ordinance into an educational system, and then they become part of the solution and not part of the problem.
Randy?
Which of the waters in the city of Ithaca in on Cornell campus that officially designated a swimming or bathing water?
There are none.
So I would say that we should take that line out.
I wouldn't take it out because it doesn't match the city ordinance. So there are public pools, and that is probably why they chose to write that way. They're not wild waters. So there are swimming pools. And there are public waters within the city of Ithaca, in the full city of Ithaca. My guess is that's why they
have it. But this is Fall Creek, Castleville Creek, or BU Lake that are on or traverse the campus and there's no pool.
It could possibly just be in the future if something was designated, assuming that it wouldn't have to change.
Yeah, so I guess if the reverse were true, if they came up in the same swimming area as one of these waterways, then the ordinance would still be able to stand and it would not be a problematic.
So,
if I could just respond to Kyle's comments, you know, the code, the campus code of conduct is, in essence, it's a penal system. I mean, obviously, we know that, you know, people, we set rules, and if they, people violate them, they're punished in a way. But at its core, it's an educational process to explain to people why things shouldn't happen and, you know, and to maintain a safer academic environment. And, you know, we need to get it out there through the campus code that this isn't allowed. You know, when you're an undergrad, this is one of the first things you do. Kathy's only know that in the fall, you're chasing people out of there all the time.
You're taking bodies out of the water and chasing people out.
Exactly. You're doing both. I mean, you know, from someone who's experienced, I'm not sure who here else has experienced that as an undergrad, but this is a pressing problem, and the fact that it's not in campus code is just asinine, to be honest. I mean, to put it bluntly.
Yeah, Sean?
I would like to ask how you see enforcing this and how you see it fitting in with education. Like, what exactly is your strategy?
Well, we have to have the authority to act on it. We're already down there doing education. We're already down there studying for trespass if people are outside the boundaries that are designated by the official pathways. We're already providing warnings to people within the water, asking them to get out, but the truth of the matter is we have absolutely no recourse if they refuse to get out, and we can't cite them for the violation. We can warn them, but there's actually a fairly remarkable YouTube video out there. You can Google it. There's a park, City of Ithaca park ranger in Six Mile Creek giving an announced warning to all the Six Mile Creek swimmers. They have a problem outside of these waters as well. And you can hear the entire crowd absolutely just making fun of and laughing at the park ranger. They're doing their job. They're telling people they can't swim in the water. They're telling them that it's prohibited. Jumping off the cliffs are prohibited. They laugh. As soon as the park ranger is done, they jump in the water. So absent an ability to enforce, the warnings literally fall in their ears.
Bridget?
You touched a little bit on my question about more, in addition to swimming and bathing, the trespassing, because there's also people that are, you know, I'm climbing the cliff, I'm not swimming on much. So can additional wording be put in there if you're including things like that?
We already have that.
Okay.
So trespass is already something we can say. Mm-hmm. The problem is once they get in the waters, then they're swimming, they're not trespassing.
Oh, because there's a water.
Right, it's a cold problem.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
Kyle?
We don't want to be outside of what our authority is.
Well, first of all, I want to be clear, I'm fully in support of municipal law.
Okay.
It's, my concern is I'm not really fully seeing the benefits of having Cornell enforce this separately of the City of Ithaca. I see all patients with the City of Ithaca to provide services, to provide a justice system, basically. And I heard Phil mention that he thought that the GAY system is educational, which is, I don't want to get into the theory of how our criminal justice system is structured. I'm not seeing why for this particular offense we processing this in-house is superior to having it go through the city and county justice system.
These are students that are drowning. The Ithaca City locals can stay out of the waters. They know better. But it's our constituency that's suffering from it.
You just got to look at it logistically. Local people who are from the area know the dangers of the gorges here. You have people who are freshmen who are coming in, are 18, 19 year old kids, who are kids, students.
You're a senior, man.
Yeah, right? Don't remind me of that either. But yeah, people coming from all over the country and all over the world. You get a pamphlet the first day you get on campus during orientation that says, stay out of the gorges. That is it. That is it. And I'm pretty sure that goes in the garbage for two-thirds of people, if not more. Within a week and a half, 2 weeks later, those same kids are gorge jumping, are bathing in the gorges, and it's a matter of time before we have another issue. And every time there's an issue, it's more bad press for Cornell. That's obviously a secondary issue because loss of life is the main issue that we're all here to prevent. But it's just, there's no need for it. There's no need for it. And obviously, I mean, I think there's history of this, you know, period, and the story. But, you know, it's something that needs to be changed, and it can be changed.
Pierre?
And I also wanted to bring forward the efforts of the student assembly. Starting in the fall, during the swim tests, there will be a video instructing students of the dangers of swimming or just approaching the gorge in any way during the swim test. So that will be while the students are waiting to take their swim test. It will be running on loop about something that the student assembly has been working on this entire year. So it's also something that the students are concerned about, and that's coming from the student assembly.
How would you spell this kind of?
I think a question.
Okay. Is there a sense? There's a sense. So, Randy, you have a sense.
What's that?
He called the question. You had a sense. So, go ahead and speak.
Well, I was just going to say that there's two things. Saving lives is important. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I think we're more at risk of the death that people die every day by not living and not understanding what life is and what risks are. So I just want to point that out. And when I see the signs on the gorge, natural area, beware, dangerous. If you ask me, the natural areas are probably the most healthy place that anyone should be in.
Second.
Yeah, I
have
a second.
Sorry. Well, all in favor?
Good. Of the question?
Yes, I'm calling the question.
Okay. It's pretty fast.
Passes 12-0. Okay, now we'll vote on the resolution. All in favor? All opposed? Motion passes 9-3. Since Joe Lally is here to present on the campus parking initiative, so we'll go ahead and move to that part of the agenda. Sorry.
You're doing the parking, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Infrastructure Committee for working. Not better than any other committee. An excellent committee. It's a pleasure to work with. It has been very productive collaboration. Okay, so here's the first question most people would want to ask. For fiscal year 13, we are proposing no increase to the perimeter, mid, or central campus rates. East Hill Plaza last year became perimeter parking as part of a phase-in. We were going to start charging perimeter rates last year. At the last minute, that was changed. We were asked to hold off a year. And in coming into this year, we were asked to phase it in over an additional 3 years. So it will move to the perimeter rate in three increments, starting in fiscal year 13. Connected to this is no increase to student rates either. We have lowered the rates for reserved spaces more in line with our actual opportunity costs associated with providing a reserved space. And the only increase is a nominal one for the cost of permits for outside vendors, treating the permits that they use for business on the Cornell campus equivalently to permits we use for business within the Cornell campus for Cornell community members. Okay, another rate that is being transitioned to the perimeter rate is the department vehicle fee. Most department vehicle permits are for central campus. We're simply proposing moving it up to the perimeter rate over 3 years. Right now, for parking on central campus, these department vehicles have been paying $60 a year. So it will move to $107 this year, and then to two-thirds of the perimeter rate next year, and the full perimeter rate the following. We are proposing increasing fines, parking fines, including the life safety fire zones, accessible parking spaces, formerly called handicap parking spaces, moving that from $50 to $75 for these larger offenses, and other fines would be going up by $5 or $10. Over time, at a meter, would be going from $15 to $20, and most of our standard violations, which are currently $30, would move to $35. As permit prices go up, fines need to also go up to help with the calculus people go through is to decide whether or not to take the risk of getting a ticket. We would far rather issue fewer tickets and have people able to find the parking that they paid for. The late fee would also increase from $10 to $15. And we're talking about implementing booting. This is part of, will become a booting and towing policy rather than what has been currently a towing policy. We're not talking about a more aggressive enforcement or enforcing any more vehicles than we currently do. This has to do with immobilizing certain vehicles that don't have to be towed. So that instead of someone coming out and finding their car gone and having to go downtown with cash to find their car and spring it from impound, they can call a number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and their car will be released for a booting fee of $60 rather than their having to go down and pay a towing fee of $100 or more. And it accomplishes the same goals of getting someone's attention who has been amassing tickets and not paying them. We will not boot vehicles that are in life safety zones, sidewalks, grass, handicap or accessible spaces, and fire lanes. Those vehicles would still be towed. And a vehicle where someone does not call to have the boot removed within 24 hours, we will remove the boot and then have the vehicle towed, rather than having it just remain there. But we want to give people a chance to go through it an easier way. It saves us time as well. It takes us about 45 minutes to complete a tow, and a boot can be applied in about 2 or 3 minutes. Okay, transportation services has some structural budget issues, partially because we provide a benefit, whether it's a transportation or parking benefit. A good topic for the senior staff in the coming year to determine how much of this benefit should be borne by the employee and how much by the university. It currently is borne by both, but how much and to what extent is a good topic for a conversation. And part of this is that the costs for what we call transportation demand management are a piece of this picture. These are things that cost the university money and don't have a revenue stream associated with them. Providing transit privileges. We provide on the order of 2.7 to 2.8 million rides on TCAT every year that the university pays TCAT for. We also pay one-third of the local share of TCAT's operating budget. Some of you may have noticed in some places, worse than others, that we've been deferring some maintenance on parking lots, and it's happened in the parking structures as well. And deferring maintenance in lots, it creates an inconvenience, a discomfort, potholes. Deferring maintenance in the parking structure can cause critical failure, so we need to take good care of those because they need to be with us a long time. They're very expensive to build. And, yep, that's it. So, any questions? Yes.
What's going to happen with, or are there any regulation changes in parking for emergency faculty?
No.
Evan?
So I understand this is probably not going to make any difference today, but I'm going to say it anyway. Now, of course, I think I'd be very happy if all the parking were just free, but I'm going to live in the real world for at least the next 5 minutes. Something that I know bothers me as the president of the Graduate Professional Student Assembly, something that I know often sticks in the craw, if you will, make sure that's in the minutes, of graduate and professional students is the differential parking rates. We look at a system where, to talk about the vet lot, for instance, you can imagine a system where the system is such that a vet student who's going to school is paying $30,000 a year in tuition, is paying $725.26 a year to park in the lot next to the vet school. The staff person who's working at the vet school is being, of course, not to diminish the wonderful work of our excellent staff, who's being paid to work at the vet school rather than paying to be at the vet school, is paying less than half what that graduate student is paying to park in that lot. So I think what to me underlies the system, this may be wrong,
is that for graduate students, parking is somehow optional, that they could take the bus or they could walk or they could bike or they could do something else, but they're choosing instead to drive, and so they need to pay more. But one could well imagine, and I'm sure this is the case for a great many students, though we don't have very good data on this, that commuting by car is just not an option. They live out in the country, they live maybe in a different town or city, and they need to drive in. And on top of that very large tuition expense, they're being asked to pay more than double what somebody else with the car right next to them is being asked to pay. So I suppose not being able to live in the world where all parking is just free, I would rather live in a world where the parking is done solely based on location, and that there's not this differentiation of rates where students are charged twice, more than twice as much as other people to park in the same spot. That's my philosophy.
Mitch.
Yeah. First of all, for those who don't know me, I just got elected last night for this year's QPSA president, Mitch Payne. I'd like to second what Evan says, and just ask, and I'll continue with that conversation next year in my capacity. One question for you about the TCAT. I know that Cornell offers Hazard the whatever fund is revenue. Is TCAT planning to ask for an increase in that funding? And if so, how does the administration see dealing with that?
Currently, TCAT is in their fiscal year 2012 and did not ask for any increased contribution from the partners. They have not yet formulated a budget for their fiscal year 13, which is calendar year.
Okay.
Yes, Randy?
What is the reason graduate students have to take more for parking space in the same lot?
Currently, all students pay the same rate, whether graduate or undergraduate, whether resident or commuter. Part of this has to do with the fact that we were talking about parking as a benefit. There is no contribution from the student side towards the expenses of providing the transportation system on campus. The employee benefits pool provides some of that university side funding. We are making a change to the number of permit types to be sold to students this year. Right now, we sell C permits, which are, you know, the sort of that mid-campus near the Crescent lot on the south side of Alumni Fields. We sell O permit, which is valid in all the O areas, including the D lot. We sell a T permit, which is available in that lot across from Humphrey Service Building on Route 366, also called the Old Oxley lot. We're instead going to offer an FC permit next year, which will be valid in any of those areas. We're reducing our number of permit types. We talked to you about this last year. We did it on the staff side. We're simplifying it on the student side also. It will give students a little more mobility and a little more choice, and it really simplifies the management and administration of that. It will still be sold at the same price. There will remain a B permit option for students, which allows parking only in the B lot adjacent to the Vet College, but that comes with a no-fee OmniRide pass, which would otherwise be $200. So encouraging students to park in the lot that is furthest from Central Campus and use transit rather than trying to find a spot closer in. So we are reducing it to two types for commuters. Student residents will still be able to park in their residential areas for the permit price.
To negotiate with the graduate school, whether the graduate school in terms of looking at this as a benefit?
I can tell you right now, you're not going to get very far with that. I mean, I'd love that. I mean, basically my point is I'm not trying to say that employees don't deserve more in benefits than they already have and so on and so forth. But if you're talking about a vet student, they're paying more than double the rate out of a loan, whereas a staff person working in the vet college is paying half the rate out of their salary. That to me is a striking difference to park in the exact same lot. I understand revenue streams and so on and so forth. I'm speaking more about philosophy.
Yeah. I just asked about exceptions having to do with hardship cases, especially say with staff. Are those set in stone rates, or
Is there any wiggle room there for?
We have had a parking hardship review committee in the past. It hasn't been active for many years at this point because it hasn't been requested for many years.
But you're going to go back to it?
It can be reconvened. I think there would be work with the university assembly to do that. Yeah.
That's us.
Regarding, is that the only free lot? The only lot that's free to staff and employees to
park? Except for some parking in E areas out on Palm Road. And that's about it at this point, because that and E area, for instance, is not accessible by public transit.
And I do realize that these are permits, it's not a guaranteed parking spot, but is there going to be concern that now that East Hills, those employees are being asked to pay, and as they keep increasing the people who need to pay, will there be a need to increase A lot, or what?
If we find that we have capacity problems in A lot, then that's we will address it at that time. We have not had that to date.
Yeah.
I would just on the student parking and graduate student parking issue, it's appropriate. I think it may be effective to bring that up to CIC next year, and we can have more time to. In the fall is really the ideal time to at least broach those issues, because it from our own perspective, it's taking 5-4 months just to get through the administrative approval.
I should say I'm very glad to see that the fees aren't going up. I know they went up, $50 last year, from $680 to $725. I'm not the music major, my math is terrible. $45.
My music is good. I just would suggest if we could bring it up in that venue in the fall, it gives us a chance to at least approach the issue.
Sure, definitely.
And work on it and maybe come to a conclusion that's acceptable to all.
A friendly amendment to that is I would recommend a conversation about transportation, not just parking.
Yes.
Only about 13% of students to 12% of students generally purchase parking.
Yeah.
Many more avail themselves of the other transportation options on and around campus.
Is that all students or graduate?
All students.
Jim? I had a question. What was the rationale for changing the fee structure for department vehicles? Most departments do need one or two, and you're just shifting department budgets to your budget. Maybe that's how you have to play it, but it seems like the dollars you'll gain from that are small.
And they have been dramatically underpriced, and they're parking in an area at around $60, where others are paying $780. So we're just talking about bringing it to the perimeter rate, and it would be a permit that would allow parking not just in central but in the perimeter. Again, it's a matter of using the resource wisely. So, and part of this is, you know, we're losing space on Central Campus at quite a clip. So we're trying to manage the resource.
Okay. Is there any other comments or questions? Seeing none. Thank you guys for coming and presenting on this. Thank you guys for coming and presenting on this. We're going to go ahead and move on to the next item on the agenda.
Next year we'll try to get a recommendation.
And we can continue this discussion as a committee or you guys.
Next year we'll, if you pass the prices, we'll write an amendment that praises your
retirement costs too.
I promise to look into it.
Okay. I find that to be very reassuring.
He's actually a nice guy. You come across very stern.
Okay, we're going to move on to Resolution 11 on proposing changes recommended by the Office of the Judicial Administrator to the Campus Code of Conduct. So, Mary Beth Grant, if you'd like to present this resolution.
Thank you very much. These are a couple of items that
have just sort of been hanging out in the background for a couple of years and some more reasons we have. I don't think there's anything terribly controversial among them, but I will go ahead and just explain the need for all of them. The first one under this resolves where we're talking about having a person, a support person for accused students. If we think about the when a complainant comes forward in the judicial process, he or she is always welcome to have an emotional support person with him or her. And that's really helpful, actually, for not only the individual, but also at a hearing when the JA is presenting a case, that we're able to really focus on what the proof is, where the witnesses are, what questions we need to ask, really pay attention. And if the complainant is having some sort of emotional crisis, his or her needs are being met without taking attention away from the JA's ability to present the case. It should have occurred to me 13 years ago, but when it comes, it comes. It just occurred to us that the same is true for accused students, that they might have an emotional crisis during a hearing or at any time, and the JCC or the attorney that is helping them through with the legal side of the issue, so to speak, making sure that their defense is being prepared and presented adequately, may not have either the skills or the ability to split their time to attend to the emotional issues. So this just adds parity to allow the accused person to have an emotional support person as well as their more legal advisor. Do you want me to go through all four of them?
If you want to just go through all four of them.
That's the point of the first one. The second one is essentially an unlawful imprisonment kidnapping section. Over the years, there have been a number of cases where part of the allegation is that a complainant is either prevented from leaving a location or taken from one location to another against his or her will. Some examples have included, where there was a roommate who pulled a knife on his roommate, and the fellow who was the complainant wasn't able to get out of the corner, because the person was sort of holding him at bay in the corner. Another example was a staff person who had invited a student into his office to, deal with whatever the issue was, and the student became very volatile, and the staff person wasn't able to exit his office. There have been other situations where in the course of a fight, I guess, the accused person allegedly, and that's one of the alleged cases, it's still not adjudicated, allegedly dragged two different complainants into another room and then wouldn't let them leave. So that one was both moving a person from one location to another and preventing the people from leaving. So it just seems like it's come up often enough without having anything to address it. So that's why I put that one forward. The next one regarding fake IDs. This is a situation that came up my very first year as JA, and I have to give a shout out to Phil because he helped me figure out how to actually address it. So here's the situation. The code very clearly prevents the use, the active forgery, the misuse of documents, and then also of different types of identification or things like that, government or non-governmental university or other types of documents. So that could include making a fake ID or forging a parking pass, those kinds of things. Those are the two that we see most often. It also very clearly prohibits the possession of forged documents. So somebody who buys the fake ID in the streets of New York and has it in his or her possession or lost wallet, that's very clearly against the code at this time. There was a case back in 99 where the hearing board said it's also a misuse of a driver's license, if it's a valid driver's license but belongs to another person, and so suppose Kathy and I are sisters, I'm older, Kathy takes my driver's license as a way to make her old enough to drink. So the hearing board had that as a finding, and never really said it explicitly in the code. And so it made me a little uncomfortable that we're relying on precedent when we could just give better notice to students. And it also made me uncomfortable that we would treat two different types of fake IDs differently. So the person who happens to have the older sister gets a pass, in theory, while the person who buys their fake ID on the streets of New York doesn't. And they're both fake IDs, So this terminology we thought would cover the situation in a very narrow way so that it's not trying to include all situations where somebody has the ID of another person.
I'm sorry, Mary Beth, the point of clarification, there's fake IDs, and then there's legitimate IDs being used for fraudulent purposes.
Exactly.
But in the case of the sister, it's a legitimate ID, and that's the piece the code doesn't cover.
Yeah.
Using a legitimate ID improperly.
Exactly. So the use of that legitimate ID in an improper way was already covered. So a float day or homecoming, when somebody offers the older sister's ID to obtain a beer, that was covered. But the possession of the sister's expired ID, the sister who lives in California and hasn't visited in months, and I just happened to have it in my wallet, that was not covered. So it's sort of equalizing the different ways that people have fake IDs. And really putting the UHB, the hearing board decision, making it more clear in the policy instead of just relying on the interpretation.
Can we just look at the wording there for a second, where it says on line 40 or 3, unlawfully possessed with the identification of another person, if that identification has a date of birth, it would make the person legal to consume alcohol at times. So, first of all, I don't understand unlawfully. Does that add anything to it, or do you just mean possess it?
Yes, it does.
What does it mean?
To spend fee. Do we add that up in the whereas?
Yes.
Clause? So it's up in the whereas clause as well as the tendency.
Yeah,
no.
It's up there.
There's a vehicle traffic law citation that I don't remember the exact number right now, but it makes vehicle traffic law prohibits a person to possess someone other than their own license.
And the reason we added it at the CJC meeting was because we wanted to make sure that there was a defense for students that if they legitimately had their older sister's license because, whatever reason, she forgot it there and we're going to be going home at Thanksgiving, I'm going to be bringing it. I mean, to provide the ability to have
so what does unlawful mean? Is that defined anywhere?
In the vehicle traffic law. So, you could refer it if you wanted to, I guess.
I think it might be a good idea because in this document I didn't understand what the law meant.
So yeah.
I was carrying my wife's ID around.
So is that a law?
The poor cheeks swell, Howie.
Without using
the way the law is stated, it is illegal to possess.
And that's also part of the reason why we wanted to narrow the language.
I can have her birth certificate and I have to take it down to courthouses to get their passports. So
there's no picture on it.
So,
what you're pointing out is exactly why
we wanted to narrow the language. So it's narrowed in two ways.
This makes it more confusing, actually.
Well,
because go ahead.
So it's narrowed in one way because it's the unlawful. So that narrowed in the second way because it's linked to it's used essentially as a fake ID. So in both of the examples that you have cited, you have your wife's ID for whatever purpose. It's not going to be a violation of the code. It might still be an unlawful possession for other reasons, but it's not going to be a violation of the code. We're only looking at folks having those IDs for the purpose of alcohol consumption. a legal opinion.
I can understand the views to that, but I'm saying suggesting.
No, you're not raising your pockets. I'm just talking.
Right. So then they would be able to argue that it's not
because I got
it. So adding the word unlawful gives the students the ability to make an argument that, hey, I'm possessing this, but I don't have an unlawful.
So Ned, let me add some clarification. You have your wife's license. She knows you have it. You know you have it. There's no reason for anybody to pull you over to cite you, even though
you wouldn't present it to that person.
Where it comes into case is Chief's owner has caught you at the slope day, thing, and she's or one of her officers processing you, and you know you have this other person's
And she is ID, just for the record.
You know. Then there's a case you made, well, okay, was it somebody transporting it because they asked, hey, I'm in the library, I forgot my ID, bring it to me. I mean, it carded my wife's purse, I forgot it, you know,
exactly.
Kind of thing. Ordinarily, it wouldn't be cited. There would be some other trigger, or my wife is going, my husband stole my license, I don't know, you know, but...
which happened also.
But so in the CJC, when you got into the issues of... giving them enough defense so that if there's a legitimate reason, they're not automatically...
Right.
And we parse out these words. The JCC and those folks are okay with them and they meaningful to them. I agree, reading it as a layperson, you're wondering what they mean by it.
It's also consistent with the way other code provisions are written now. If you look at the code provision with respect to alcohol and the code provision thing with respect to drugs, it talks about the unlawful possession of alcohol or something along those lines, the unlawful possession of other drugs. I don't know the exact terminology, but Kevin Claremont, you know, thinks that he really worked on making sure the language throughout the code is consistent. He really was careful to make sure that it sort of matched up and is parallel in the language.
So, I mean, we got to remember here, this is clearly towards undergraduate students, and that when you go, whether it be in fraternity houses, sorority houses, clubs on this campus, there are people who look like other people who give each other ideas. It happens. I've seen it happen. You know, and if you have a brother who's older than you or a sister who's older than you, that has exactly. You know. You're heading to the college town bar 2 years early or 2 years early. But this stuff happened. And again, not to bring up the word asinine, but it's asinine if I had a fake ID that said Philip Goldstein on it that I bought at a bazaar in New York City for me to get in trouble. But if I had an older brother, which I don't, if I had an older brother who looked like me, then I wouldn't get in trouble. Just doesn't make sense.
Evan?
I just wanted to talk about the word unlawful. The discussion in the CJC was basically that there would be, that officers would use common sense and this sort of thing. The CJC just wanted to clarify what the sound of that would look like. The question that came up in our meeting was, so what if my brother's ID is sitting in his wallet on the other side of my room and I'm in there? Is that possession? This the word unlawfully makes it, we thought, the CJC thought, clear enough that when an officer is in that situation that they'll have that the criteria that the officer will be using to discern whether or not there's an issue here will be clear to the defendant.
And if the officer gets it wrong, the process itself will give.
And we did stay away from the word with intent to use unlawfully. It is the possession that's the problem. And of course, if you can't use it without the possession,
so caught in the act is a lot harder than, you know, why would you have this in your on your person for, you know, just day in, day out? Oh, because at some point you're probably intend to use it.
I just want to note it's 5:53, and I think we have one other thing on our agenda.
So the last one on here is actually pretty straightforward. A couple of years ago, as you know, we added off-campus jurisdiction and more cases have come up where there's been trespass on private property, and currently the total rate covers trespass on university property. And it also comes up at fraternities that are not university owned, mm-hmm. where folks want somebody to move from their property and held accountable under the code. And it says non-university owned fraternity, we can't hold that person accountable. So we want to make sure that there's, again, equality parity.
Yeah, I'd like to. I have a number of points I'd like to make in opposition to this. If you guys are done presenting the,
get that.
Okay. First of all, I'm concerned. I'm not sure. Just from I've talked to a lot of grad students about campus code issues over the last month or two, and I get the impression a lot of grad students don't really know what's in the code. So I'm actually kind of questioning whether we should be expanding the code at all right now until we really know that all members of the community know what's in there. I have similar concerns about these provisions that I brought up about the board of safety with R10. I'm concerned that it seems like that either people are going to be subjected to double punishment or that people will be going through the JA process as an alternative to being processed through the county and our local justice system. And as a citizen of this county, as a taxpayer, I feel strongly that where you are, in the community should not influence the type of justice you receive. I feel strongly about that. I get the impression certainly other graduate students in sociology feel strongly about that. When I look at these provisions, I guess what I'm asking myself, does the university have any specific interest in processing this in-house as opposed, I can believe that there are certainly certain things that are intrinsic to our mission as a university, things that relate to our research mission, our public service mission, our educational mission, but when it comes to conduct that's really outside of work hours, if people just happen to be living on the campus, I'm not so sure that I'm not so sure that the JA process is appropriate for some of these crimes. I don't feel like I've heard justification in the last 20 minutes for why these are specifically better to be handled in-house as opposed to in the larger system out there.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like some of these provisions are a little bit vague. The trespassing one, I was wondering if there was any particular property that we were concerned, private property that we were concerned about people trespassing on. I'm worried. I do believe that trespassing is one of those minor offenses of trespass. Certainly, I know there's been cases involving the New York City Police Department where they perhaps targeted minorities disproportionately unfairly. Mm-hmm. And the LACP that sued the NYPD last year, alleging that trespassing is a law that's sometimes applied unfairly mm-hmm. toward minorities. I feel like I'm not seeing why, unless somebody can make, I fully believe it's a research lab on campus. There are things that are related to our educational research mission where we want some forced trespassing, but I'm concerned about this expansion of the blanket trespassing clause. I think that we've gone over everything we want to the fake IDs for that, and I don't think I'm going to comment on that one. And again, I feel like the restriction to the kidnapping restricting egress portion, I'm just not sold that that's something that the university has a compelling interest in pursuing through the JA system.
Yeah, I'll let you
into
that.
Just in a nutshell, Kylan, I appreciate your thoughts. To take a step back, the philosophy of having the code of conduct at all on campus, I think goes to the question of who sets the rules for us in our campus. One of the things, so two different things that you said. One is you want to avoid double jeopardy, and then second, why can't we just have everything double jeopardy in our justice system? And I think that philosophically, the university has the interest in maintaining order and an educational environment that goes beyond the classroom or the lab. Often the work that happens in labs or in classrooms is really done through the academic integrity world, whereas the code of conduct is trying to set ethical standards, behavioral standards in a much broader sense, thinking of education in a much broader sense. One of the ways that I often think about the differences between the criminal justice system and the kind of closed conduct system is that we have different focuses and different end goals. Ours, I think other people have already said, is more educational in nature, both to try to help a person who's made a mistake, and we all make mistakes, to learn and grow from that mistake, and then also to help the community thrive and have a place with high ethics and high behavioral standards. So another way to think about it is that the criminal justice system can put somebody in jail, but they can't have somebody removed from campus if they're a danger or threat to our campus. So two different systems, two different end goals. Double jeopardy itself doesn't apply because it's not a constitutional issue, although there are provisions in the code that say we want to try to work to make sure somebody's not being doubly punished. And so we can take that into consideration. If somebody has paid restitution through a criminal justice process, we're not going to have to pay restitution through a criminal, through a campus disciplinary process, too. And we also take steps to make sure that they're not going to be an impact in the case. But your points are much broader philosophical points than these particular issues, I think.
Yeah.
Is there a motion to extend the meeting to the 6 o'clock?
Motion to extend the meeting.
All in favor? All opposed? Motion passes. Phil? Sorry.
I'll make my comments quick. You really got to look at this from an undergraduate perspective, because, I mean, in reality, you got to call a spade a spade. These are undergraduate issues. I mean, you could argue with me over that, but that's personally what I think. Just because, you know, for example, this type of stuff, especially with the trespassing, could happen at fraternity and sorority houses, which, and I don't know the exact specific, maybe Chief Zoner knows how many are university-owned to own by themselves.
Only about 12 of our 45 chapters three chapters are university.
Okay, so majority of them are two-thirds of them are not university owned. There could be trespassing issues in those houses, and when that happens, it could cause a situation where if you're in a class with that person, it could disrupt your academic environment, which is exactly what the campus code is there to avoid. So, I mean, to be honest, I think it's very much relevant to the campus code, and I think it's all these things are very, very, very relevant to the campus code, as opposed to being just used on the criminal system.
Any other questions or comments on this resolution?
I guess I have two quick questions. With the whole preventing a person from leaving the room, do you think this is just about adding charges to existing things that otherwise would be brought into your office, or would this be something that you think you would have cases of just this being the issue?
That's a good question. I think that it could go either way. I think that for the kidnapping, unlawful imprisonment one, most of the examples that I can think of, cases where I thought, oh, I can't believe we don't have this, most of those would be in addition to a harassment or an assault complaint, but not exclusively. I mean, it wouldn't be limited to that. And for the trespass, same thing, it can go either way. Sometimes the trespass is a person walking into another person's apartment and, you know, acting in a threatening manner. Sometimes it might be somebody going into another person's room and urinating on their bed or something like that. For off-campus cases, we would need to consider the serious aspect as well, that's tied to it.
Mm-hmm. And with the ID, would this is just a clarification, it doesn't actually change.
That's my feeling. I feel like the hearing board interpreted the code a number of years ago to include this kind of possession of that type of fake ID, but we've been applying the hearing board decision, but it doesn't give as good notice as it could have given. So that's my interpretation.
I just have a quick question for the second to last resolve clause. So if I am holding my friend's ID for them in my bag or something lawfully because they are for like a good reason, like they asked me to hold it for them, like to bring it to them or something like along those lines, I wouldn't get in trouble. But if I was using it, then I would get in trouble. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So it is the possession of it that could be the problem. You know, say a lost wallet. Sometimes we'll find fake IDs in the lost wallet that was turned into criminal police.
Mm-hmm.
Then the person could come back to us and say, you know, I did have my friend's ID in my wallet, but here is for the lawful purposes that I had it for. So it's not automatic. There's still a defense to it. The way it was originally written, there was essentially no defense.
Okay.
And just to give you an example of the myriad that comes through our offices, most of the time we're dealing with these types of issues through medical transport. So
yeah.
Some have been severely intoxicated,
mm-hmm.
But they don't even know where they are. So we follow up the next day, and the alcohol doesn't need to be admitted to being purchased on that identification card. In those particular cases, we refer for that possession. For a case where a wallet comes in lost and found, and a person claims it's their own, and one of those pieces of identification is clearly not their own, then we have an educational session. And we sit down with it and say, okay, well, there's probably two reasons why you might have this. One is that you're really good friends, you're holding this because so-and-so didn't have their purse on them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The other is that's going to get you in trouble because it is against the law, and you should return that as quickly as possible. And the other is that you're using it to purchase alcohol, because I notice a very striking resemblance to this individual who just happens to be 2 years older than you. So we have that conversation, but there's no charges that are, you know, preferred at that point. Additionally, if we find things that are laying about or we can't return to the owner, then if the person then takes that wallet and says, that's not my ID, and gives it back to us and doesn't claim ownership on there, then the identification is shipped back to the Department of Motor Vehicles or wherever the issuing agent is of that particular identification for either reissue or redistribution.
Okay. Any further discussion on...
I just wanted... I think it's Randy's question, so I don't know if anybody else wanted to know, but one of the relevant state laws about it seems to be Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 509-6.
Mm-hmm.
Which says no licensee
shall voluntarily permit any other person to use his license, nor shall any person at any time possess or use any forged, fictitious, or illegally obtained license, or use any license belonging to another person. So,
that's
number six.
Right.
But not to, no, you read through it carefully and you get to stare at it. The issue is a person cannot give you permission to have the license. So if you have it, then you're already illegal.
I can't be given permission to have the license and use the license in that form.
That's not the way the law reads. And that's not the way it's used typically. So I'm not saying that everybody's cited for it.
Yeah. But I think it would get quite complicated to get all of the unlawful uses because, you know, there's one section that deals with unlawful use for operating a motor vehicle, and I'm sure there are other ones that deal with use for
identification use, and there's that one is strictly
for
possession.
So,
just given the amount of time, we have a motion to call the question. Yeah.
All in favor? All opposed?
No.
Oh, this is the question.
This is to call a question, not to pass the resolution.
Call the question.
Okay, motion passes. All in favor of the resolution? All opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes 6-2-1.
6-3-1.
No. 6-2-2. 6-2, sorry. 6-2-2. Right, because you abstained?
I abstained.
Okay.
I abstained.
Okay. So I adjourn this meeting at 6. There's other things on the agenda.
Randy's gone.
Randy's gone.
He was just wanted to inform you of some things that were happening. It was not vital. And there was Ramsey's.
Yeah.
Ramsey.
Just real quickly talking about the course evaluation.
I don't have the actual resolution on me or the one that I drafted, but we talked about it in the campus welfare meeting, and some things that still need to be determined would be, you know, getting a hold of the engineering person, the registrar in engineering,
mm-hmm.
Who created the course evaluation system, and to explain to us what we want to know from them is, you know, how did they convince or how did they, you know, explain themselves to the faculty of having the course evaluation. The other thing that was brought up at the meeting was that, you know, faculty would not necessarily be amenable to that. There has to be something that students would have to, I guess, barter, or I guess that's kind of how they phrased it, but like if they required students to complete the course evaluation, and if they didn't, mm-hmm. this was like one of the proposals they had, is that if they didn't, you know, their grades would be withheld for a certain amount of time, like 20 days or something. Personally, I was against it, but those are the things that are being discussed, but more importantly, before we bring this resolution, we wanted to understand who's and then the how's, more importantly, so that when it does get passed, hopefully, you know, we know who to go to, what system's going to be used, how long it's going to
take. That sounds like good information to get first. Evan, did you have a question?
Is this going to be in the fall then?
Yes,
yeah,
that's what I
intend to do. The resolution?
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the students filling out course evaluations.
It was an issue about students filling out course evaluations, but for me it was also an issue about having those course evaluations accessible to students. So
okay.
Engineering has a course evaluation system. The hotel school has a course evaluation system. The other colleges that I've been contacting have not shown that they have a course evaluation system that's accessible.
Yeah.
But
I suppose what I would say, I know we're over time. I may have objections to this kind of stuff. I will want to see what the final language looks like.
Mm-hmm.
As someone
okay.
who is from time to time course evaluating. I'm very conscious of the fact that sometimes these evaluations are extremely small sample sizes.
Mm-hmm.
You've got three or four people evaluating you in a class
mm-hmm.
where you have a section of maybe 10. That's a very different situation than an engineering class with 500 people
mm-hmm.
filling out evaluations. I think it's important when we're dealing with privacy issues, both for the students and for the faculty, that be respected. And secondly, I will very quickly, knowing we're over time, in some places the evaluations are done handwritten, or they're circled on things, and they'd be very difficult to aggregate and publish without people retyping everybody's evaluation, so on and so forth. Anyway, I withhold judgment. I will want to see what that final resolution looks like. Heck, you may not have to deal with me because I'm not on this body in the fall. but I'll be telling Kyle and Mitch and Liz.
That's your last will and testament.
my thoughts. So thanks, Randy.
Okay. Is there any last comedy?
Well, I could explain to him. I'll just explain after class, but I mean, not after class. I personally just want to thank you guys again for a really wonderful year. I made cookies for you guys. Like, feel free. Like,
they're delicious.
I made them from scratch. You know?
Okay.
So,
and then the other time, we did not ask Randy if he wants to bring that up at our last meeting. And I will adjourn this meeting, but I just want to say thank you to everyone.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.